And thanks to Product Earth as well for putting this on. You know, we wouldn't be able to have this platform to communicate with everyone if it wasn't for them. That's the most important thing. So we're going to hand over to Radical Russ Belleville now. This is the man who actually inspired the whole of the UK Cannabis Social Clubs movement. I went over to the States because of this guy. I was ill in bed, I was hospitalised, and after listening to his podcast for about, you know, 6 months, I'd become friends with him and on the show, you know, just on the online chat. And his assistant actually told me, get the hell out of the UK, they're killing you, you're going to die. I've been given 5 years left to live, and if I didn't take the advice to, you know, come out here to Oregon, eat the cannabis oil, I wouldn't be here standing here today. There wouldn't be UK CSEs, so I completely blame everything of the last 6 years on Radical Russ Belleville. Thank you so much for coming to the UK.
All right. Thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate it. As you can see, my name is Russ Belleville. I go by Radical Russ online, and you'll find me on every social media thing, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, I don't know, MySpace. Does that still exist, MySpace? I don't know. But you'll be able to find me on that, and my show is The Marijuana Agenda. I do it every weekday live. It'd be 11 p.m. your time, so I doubt you'll want to watch live, but it's a podcast, so you can pick it up on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and all those other outlets. So today, what I want to talk about is the 5-year impact of marijuana legalization in the United States of America. As you know, we legalized in now 8 states. 2 of those states, Washington and Colorado, legalized back in 2012. So we've got 5 years worth of data on this. And for this presentation, I'm not going to ask you to take my word for it, because I'm a stoner. I have an ulterior motive. I like smoking weed. This is all data from the states themselves. This is government bureaucrats working behind a computer, calculating what's going on and what their actual data show. So to start this, though, I'd like to get a little background and let you know a little bit of the brief history of marijuana prohibition in the United States. And by the way, a quick note. I use the term marijuana and cannabis a little bit interchangeably, but I do believe there's a specific difference. Cannabis is the entire plant. Marijuana is the dried flowering tops of cannabis plants, usually seedless, that are prepared for smoking or vaporization. So I have that little thing, but I hope you'll forgive me if I use them interchangeably. I'm so used to speaking American, so I'll go with marijuana. But we had cannabis on our continent, North America, ever since your forefathers first colonized. 1611, the first plantation of hemp took place in the Jamestown colony, and by 1619, King James was decreeing that my forefathers, the colonists, had to grow hemp. We had to supply hemp to the British Empire. You needed it for all the sails and the rigging on the ships, and it was a very important crop. It also was a crop that had a lot to do with the importation of Africans enslaved in our country to harvest those hemp crops. This is an actual lithograph of George Washington, first president, and his slaves tending hemp fields. So I always like to point out that when we talk about the founding fathers cultivating hemp, not a single damn one of them ever actually touched a hemp plant. They were having enslaved Africans doing that for them. So hemp was well known, and the use of cannabis as a medicine was kind of somewhat known, but by 1850, we had a great breakthrough in that Dr. O'Shaughnessy, a British physician, went back to India, started studying what was going on with their use of cannabis as a medicine, brought that back to England, brought that back, and that led to it getting to the United States. We added it to our U.S. pharmacopoeia, and that was like the official register of legal medicines in the United States. So if you think about it, from 1850 on, we had legal cannabis medicine in the U.S., and nobody seemed to have a problem with it. Everybody seemed to like that just fine. Until we get to around 1906, we had an act called the Pure Food and Drug Act, and what this was all about was they had the rise of the snake oil salesmen, guys who were selling all sorts of patent medicines made out of God knows what, and people were getting sick or dying from it. And so Congress said, you know, you ought to have to label what's in your medicines, and this is when cannabis first got labeled as a medicine. Before that, it was just a home preparation. The first bans we start to get in marijuana in the United States come from a reaction to the Mexican Revolution of 1910. We had an influx of Mexican immigrants And the states along the border didn't like that so much. Some of the same issues we still deal with today in the United States, the fear of people taking jobs or changing cultures. And I always illustrate this to point out how much institutional racism has to do with our prohibition of cannabis in America. And right there, from the very beginning, we had 1619 to 1910, we had 3 centuries where nobody cared about cannabis until the Mexicans started coming over the border with their so-called loco weed, and that became a problem. This led to states starting to ban cannabis at the individual state level. By 1930, we have the creation of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, our first government organization dedicated to stamping out the evils of drugs. And by 1937, we finally get the Marijuana Tax Act, which is our first prohibition of marijuana in the United States. Now, this Federal Bureau of Narcotics, a very important thing to note about this was the guy who was in charge of it, a guy by the name of Harry J. Anslinger. Harry J. Anslinger had that job at the Federal Bureau of Narcotics as our first so-called drug czar, setting the standard for our American drug laws from 1930 to 1962. For a third of a century, this guy was in charge of setting what the policy would be on drugs. Policies that led through Hemp for Victory, all the way to the Boggs Act, our first mandatory sentences, all the way to the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, the international treaty that roped in the UK, that roped in most of the European countries, the South American countries. That man right there is why you can't have cannabis. Here, there, or anywhere, this one guy in American history had the biggest impact. Yeah, that's very appropriate. Thank you. Give him any salute you feel proper, this guy. Now, why is Harry J. Anslinger such a big deal to me? Because of what a virulent, racist bigot this man was. Let me flash a quote on the screen here. I'm going to read it word for word, and I hope I'll apologize for any offense anyone may take, but I believe in accurately reporting our history. Marijuana influences Negroes to look at white people in the eye, step on white men's shadows, and look at a white woman twice. Reefer makes darkies think they're as good as white men. The primary reason to outlaw marijuana is its effect on the degenerate races. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others. Colored students at the University of Minnesota parting with white female students, smoking marijuana, and getting their sympathy with stories of racial persecution, result, pregnancy. This isn't some guy talking to the guys at the country club. This is testimony in front of the United States Congress that led to our banning of marijuana. Now, the banning of marijuana, watch that step, Russ. Banning marijuana happened there in 1937, and it ran all the way through 1969 for a very interesting little quirk in American law. When they banned marijuana, it was 7 years after they had ended alcohol prohibition. Alcohol prohibition took a constitutional amendment to enact because at the time, the American people did not believe the federal government had the power to ban anything. In our Constitution, we have a commerce clause that says the commerce between the states, the federal government can regulate that. But a ban isn't commerce. It's no commerce. So back then, America didn't think you could actually ban alcohol. They had to have a constitutional amendment. So when it came around to 1937, and they wanted to ban marijuana on the federal level, they didn't really ban it. It was perfectly legal to have marijuana. You just had to have a tax stamp. Well, the problem with the tax stamp was, how do you get your tax stamp? You had to bring your marijuana in to get it weighed. If you brought the marijuana in to get it weighed, you didn't have a tax stamp, did you? And then you'd get busted. So it was a law you couldn't follow. You couldn't bring the weed in to get it weighed to get the tax stamp to follow the law to have the weed. And Dr. Timothy Leary, do you know this guy? The tune-in, turn-on, drop-out acid guru from Harvard? Dr. Timothy Leary looked at that and went, wait a minute. Under the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, we have a right against self-incrimination. If I have to bring the weed in to get it weighed to follow the law, I'm incriminating myself by bringing in that weed. And the Supreme Court agreed and outlawed the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. So that's why marijuana's been legal since 1969. No, no. They weren't going to rest on their laurels and let us have some sort of technicality make marijuana legal. That leads to this fella. Richard Milhouse Nixon, the 37th President of the United States. Now, he was elected the year I was born, 1968. And we were deep in the middle of the Vietnam War. And there was a lot of upheaval in America from the left and a lot of radical protests. And we had the Black Power movement that was happening and the Civil Rights era. A lot of upheaval going on in the United States. And Nixon came around with Congress and pushed through the Controlled Substances Act, which made all the schedules, which bans marijuana at this point. Now, I also bring up Richard Nixon to once again illustrate the racism inherent in our banning of marijuana. There was a guy who worked for Nixon named John Ehrlichman. He was a domestic policy advisor. He was involved in the Watergate conspiracy. I actually did time in Watergate. And in 1994, this journalist named Dan Baum was doing a story for Harper's Magazine and wanted to find out from Ehrlichman, what was the war on drugs all about? What were you guys thinking when you came up with the war on drugs? This is the quote, again, from John Ehrlichman. You know, want to know what this was really all about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. That's the government admitting. It's like bald-faced right out in front. We criminalize weed to crack down on hippies and black people. And they continue to do it today. But we fought back. In 1973, my state became the first state to decriminalize marijuana. Oh, please, please don't throw us in a cage. Just give us a fine. Oh, please, just don't cage us. And 11 states followed suit in the 1970s. In the 1980s, we had the backlash, though. Ronald Reagan, the Parents Movement, Nancy Reagan, Just Say No, and we ended up with mandatory minimum sentences, where judges have to put people who grow cannabis in prison for longer sentences than child rapists. We had the Clinton crime bill, which put a whole bunch more cops on the streets and led to greater racist enforcement of our laws with stop and frisk in places like New York City. But again, we started to fight back. In 1996, California passes the first medical marijuana law. By 2010, California is making the first real effort to try to get marijuana legalized. And I bring 2010 up because I feel like the UK and the folks I've been talking to here, you guys are at about the 2009-2010 jumping point here. I'm really sensing you're close to a major breakthrough, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later on in the presentation. This is me in 2010 at Oaksterdam University in Oakland covering the election. We lost. It was only a 46% that we got. And Cannabis Carry and Rolla-J, if some of you know from my social media feed. Anyway, by 2012, Washington and Colorado legalized. 2014, we get two more states and our nation's capital. And 2016, four out of five states that were voting on legalization passed their legalization. So we are moving forward. Okay, so let's get to legalization. That's what you're all here for. Let's get it legalized, right? When we talk about legalization in the states, we oftentimes see this map. There's the simple legalization map. And you may not know American geography as well, but I'm from here, Portland, Oregon, right there on the border of Washington, or Washington there and Oregon there. We got California, Nevada, Alaska, which is really up there somewhere, but we always put it down there on a map, and Colorado, Massachusetts, Maine, and the District of Columbia. With those set of states legalized, we have 68 million Americans that live in a legal state. That's 21% of our population. One out of five Americans lives in a state that's legal. And those are the states. We told you all about that. In fact, it makes it so two of our six time zones are legal. The Alaskan and Pacific time zones, with a small sliver of Idaho, like this little tiny sliver right there of Idaho up in the top doesn't count. But other than that, the whole Pacific time zone, legal states. And then maybe you'll see the medical marijuana, right? These are the green states that have medical, but also keep in mind, all those blue states still have medical too. So this is the 29 medical marijuana states they talk about. 200 million Americans, 62%, 3 out of 5 Americans lives in a state with access to medical cannabis of some sort. But I don't like these maps. I think these maps give you a distorted view of what's going on. Because yeah, sure, California is a medical state, and New Jersey is a medical state, but they are nowhere near alike when it comes to being medical states. The first thing, and this is something I hope UK activists, and I saw with UK Cannabis Social Clubs, the right to grow is the first thing listed. This is a big fight that's happening now in the United States, is whether or not we should have that right to grow. Out of these blue states, the legal states, and these green states, the lighter shaded ones are states in which you cannot grow your own. Now there's some variation, like in Arizona, you can grow your own if you live farther than 25 miles from a dispensary. Everyone in Arizona lives within 25 miles of a dispensary, so effectively no one can grow. Massachusetts, you can grow, but you have to have a hardship exemption if you're a medical grower. You have to prove that going to the dispensary is too much hardship for you. And other states, Washington still has no home grow. Nevada added a 25-mile halo too. If you live within 25 miles of a legal pot shop in Nevada, you can't grow your own. So that's a big fight now. And you'll notice these ones that don't allow cannabis growing on the medical side are all the states that have passed since 2010. So like our first raft of states that passed all allowed home grow, and the last bunch that passed don't. Now to me, the miracle of medical marijuana isn't that it's a plant that heals people. We got lots of those, aloe vera for example. The miracle of medical marijuana is I don't have to go to a pharmacist. I don't have to go to a doctor. I can grow my own plant and heal myself, like those last folks were talking about. These states take that away. You can't grow your own plant and heal yourself. You got to go to the special building with a special preparation that is the only legal option. How different is that from pharmaceuticals? I have to choose what they give me. So I'm much more a proponent of these states that allow the growing. We also have now the latest development, no smoking. Medical marijuana states where you cannot grow your own, and when you go to the dispensary, you cannot purchase herb. All you can get is sprays, lotions, tinctures, pills. Again, how's that different from pharmaceuticals? That's what we're trying to get away from. So as you're fighting for your legalization, make sure you're fighting for what we call whole plant medical marijuana, that you want to make sure you have access to the herb itself. And then another wrinkle in our politics is we have now all these states for medical CBD, these purple states. And this started in Utah in 2014, one of our most conservative states, the home of the Mormon religion right there. And all those scenes of little kids getting their epilepsy treated magically turned these states around on believing in medical cannabis. But again, it's limited. It's only cannabidiol oil, and they don't let you grow it. You have to go to Colorado, get your oil, break federal law to take it back to Alabama. So we have a long way to go too still. That does cover another third of the American population though, and what that means is we're left with just 4 states, Idaho, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Louisiana, that recognize no legal cannabis in any form for anybody for any reason at any time whatsoever. That means only 3.73% of our population lives under absolute prohibition. Glass half full, glass half empty, you gotta look at it the right way. And I was born in this state right here. This is actually the only state in America that vetoed a CBD law for epileptic kids. Vetoed it. Amazing. So that's where we're at right now. Now let's talk about where we've been, where we're going. Legalization happened in 2012. Before legalization was voted on, we had all sorts of talking heads, all these anti-pot people get on TV to tell us what terrible things would happen if we legalized cannabis. I've broken them down into 5 basic categories. Number 1, a category I called WOTC. What about the children? What about the children? It'll send the wrong message to the kids. They'll think pot is cool. They'll start smoking it. They'll drop out of school. They'll get poisoned. Oh, it'll be terrible. Number two, stoned mayhem on the freeways. Oh, we can't legalize pot. Those stoners will get behind the wheel. They'll drive. They'll wreck. They'll kill people. It'll be awful. Number three, the Sabbat conjecture. This is named after the leading opponent in the United States of legalization. His name's Kevin Sabbat. And his conjecture is, oh yeah, you could legalize weed, but then the resulting social costs would dwarf the tax revenues. It would be terrible. You'd never make enough money to deal with all the mayhem. Number four, Big Tobacco 2.0. The idea that, oh, the marijuana is going to become this big industry like the tobacco industry, and it's going to try to addict kids, and it's going to lie, and it's going to do all sorts of shenanigans. And number five, they know that the war on drugs is racist, so they try their best to backpedal that by saying, oh, well, this would be no good in the hood. Just like alcohol, all of the pot shops will be located in the minority neighborhoods, and they'll take advantage of the minorities. So these were their predictions, and I'm going to play you some videos of their predictions from 2011 and 2012, and then we're going to take a look at data from the state of Colorado and the state of Washington that addresses those very scares. We'll start with a guy named Patrick Kennedy. He was a former congressman, also an OxyContin addict who wrecked his car in 2006 in Washington, D.C., and when the cops caught him, they gave him a ride home. They gave him a ride home. Yeah, he got away with it. So Kennedy is the co-founder of a group called Project SAM, which stands for Smart Approaches to Marijuana. I like to call them Project Samuel. Smart Approaches to Marijuana Use Except Legalization, because they're an anti-legalization group. This is what he had to say about what about the children.
So this notion that we're going to give the green light of permissibility for people to think, oh, it's harmless, go ahead and experiment. Now, we know kids have access to this anyway, but we shouldn't be adding fuel to the fire.
So the idea that if we legalize, kids are going to get more access, more fuel to the fire. You remember when you're a kid, you wanted to get some booze, you found some adult to buy some, you snuck it out of your parents' liquor cabinet. Oh my God, the kids will use more. The data disagree. This is from the Washington State Office of Financial Management. It's a graph that's showing us the rate of use, current use, is a kid using pot this month for 12th graders, 10th graders, 8th graders, and 6th graders. And what they found was no change in 12th grade use. Well, I'll tell you why. Making a legal pot shop doesn't make it easier for a teenager to get weed. They check IDs at the legal pot shop. The teenager already has a hookup. He's already got a place to go, and legalization doesn't change that. And the younger use went down. Youth use went down when we legalized. We also found how many teens started smoking pot before the age of 13. This is called early initiation. Early initiation amongst 10th graders went down. For the other grades, they saw no statistical difference. So legal pot is not causing the kids to start any younger than they used to. We found access. We asked them, if you wanted to try to get weed, would it be easy or fairly easy? For the 12th graders, it stayed about the same. For the 10th graders, it went down a little. Really, not much change. Because again, how does a legal pot shop make it easier for a kid to get access when they're checking ID there? It would make teen addicts? No. This is the rate of teenagers being sent to rehab for marijuana. That's the point where we legalized, and it went down. No more teen addict. And when it comes to school, they said, oh, kids will drop out of school, they'll lose IQ points, they'll lose their memory. No, what we found is one out of 250 kids in Washington State was suspended for marijuana. Just one, that's 0.4%. That rate hasn't changed in years either. But there is one area that was a little scary, and that is increase in poison control calls and ER visits. This is the fear that the little kid gets into the marijuana gummy bear, and then they have to take the kid to the ER because he's getting a little comatose, a little too high. And they did find that this was before legalization, this was after legalization, it did go up. However, you have to just use a little common sense with this one. Did more kids eat pot, or were more parents honest about what their kid ate? Think about it. It's not a poison. It can't poison a kid. But legalization removes that fear. Like, I'll bet the calls for, gee, my kid got food poisoning went way down. Because now the parents can be honest about what the kid got into. And when they talk about this related to marijuana in the ER, there's an increase in ER visits, emergency room visits for people related to marijuana. What related to marijuana means is, A, you mentioned marijuana, or B, they found it in your system. So, if a week ago I smoked a joint, and then today I got in the car and I'm sitting at the turn and I got T-boned by a drunk driver, and when they run my blood, they find THC in it, they'll say that's a marijuana-related ER visit. Even though I was sober at the time, had nothing to do with my getting hit by the car, that would be considered a marijuana-related ER visit. So, yeah, are there more marijuana-related ER visits? Sure, because now that weed's legal, more people can use it. It'd be like saying there's more married gay men getting into car wrecks. Well, yeah, because now there can be married gay men. It has nothing to do with the car wreck. And then, oh yeah, this is their poison control, where this is a Project Sam graph. This is our opponents trying to scare us. Look at all those kids getting poisoned. But then they failed to point out that in 2017, that number dropped a whole bunch once we started putting out ad campaigns and some public education.
The British Medical Journal told us a few months ago that their most comprehensive study they've ever done showed that marijuana intoxication doubles your car crash risk.
Oh no, marijuana doubles your car crash risk. Well, Washington State found in the past 5 years no significant change in traffic fatalities. They found a 29% decrease in DUIs related to marijuana. And even though they were testing more drivers, doing more blood tests, they were finding that the average of the amount of marijuana is going down in people's blood, and fewer people are over the limit. So legalization is not causing this stoned mayhem on the freeways that they worried about. And this leads me to a general discussion about cannabis and driving, because this is something you guys will have to deal with in your activism. There's a big fear that if we legalize pot, suddenly there'll be a bunch of stoned drivers and things will be out of control. I always say, legalization doesn't invent cars and marijuana. People have been driving stoned for years. And we haven't yet seen a big problem with that. When we first legalized in Washington State, one of the local TV stations decided to take a look at this. Washington State had set a 5-nanogram limit. So if they test your blood and they find 5 nanograms of THC, you're automatically guilty. Kind of like BAC for alcohol, if you're above a 0.08 or 0.05 or whatever it is. So they took 3 tokers out. One who was a newbie, one who was a regular toker, and then this girl, Addie Norton, 27-year-old medical marijuana patient. We call her all day Addie. They had these drivers smoke weed every 20 minutes with a driving instructor in the car and a cop outside the car who's trained in drugs to watch these people drive. Check out what happens with All Day Addie.
Our first volunteer, Addie, is a 27-year-old medical marijuana patient and heavy daily user who had smoked some pot prior to arriving. A blood test before our experiment began showed she came to the track already 3 times the new legal limit for driving under the influence of marijuana. The limit is 5 nanograms. She was at nearly 16 nanograms. While learning the course, Addie turned too sharp at a stop sign and clipped one of our cameras. But the instructor told us her driving was actually fine.
Her driving was actually fine at 3 times the limit. Now in America, 3 times the limit for alcohol would be a 0.24 blood alcohol. I don't think you'd be driving real fine after a 0.24. But then they take them back and they give them some more marijuana.
Back behind the wheel for another lap, Addie drove a bit slower than she should and at one point struck a traffic cone.
Oh, I hit a cone. I see it in the rearview mirror. Ah!
A blood test would later show Addie was driving at 7 times the legal limit for pot with 36.7 nanograms of marijuana in her system, but still driving okay.
I wouldn't pull her off the road, though. You know, not yet. Not
okay.
Still driving okay.
After 0.9 gram, Addie was becoming much more aggressive, excited about being high and behind the wheel.
One time in your life you get to do this, you should do it.
Yeah.
You should do it. Yeah.
But she made no major mistakes, and we asked the officer if he would pull her over.
Borderline.
borderline. 11 times the legal limit, borderline. You know what you get 11 times the legal limit for alcohol? Dead. You'd be dead. You wouldn't even be driving. You'd be dead. So all this scare about the stone mayhem on the freeway, it's BS, people. We are no
for every dollar we get on alcohol and tobacco tax in this country, we spend $10 in lost social costs. So people that look at this know this is actually a loss leader.
This is a scare they tried to paint where they said for every dollar you get from marijuana, from alcohol tax, you cost $10 in social costs. For every dollar in tobacco tax, $10 in social costs. Well, that's true. Because alcohol and tobacco are toxic and addictive. Of course they cause social costs. Here's what really happened. $114 million a month in Washington State marijuana revenue is generating $26 million a month in tax revenue. We find border counties near the prohibition state of Idaho are outselling counties in like Seattle. We find that the initial price of marijuana, which started about $29 per gram, is now down to $10 per gram. That's with tax, $10 a gram. Not so bad. And there's over 250 retailers in the state of Washington now. And marijuana legalization is taking the cops' time away from dealing with weed and dealing with other drugs. This blue bar, this light blue bar, is how many incidents they had with marijuana. That's an interface with a cop and a suspect. 6,000 incidents in 2011, or 2012, before we legalized, dropped to 2,600 incidents. Meanwhile, the incidences with amphetamine, heroin, and other drugs have increased because now the cops can direct their attention to those drugs instead of marijuana. And we're finding the convictions have dropped. This is the line for convictions with no jail, convictions with jail for any sort of marijuana crime. So we're saving that money in the prisons, we're saving that money in the jails and the courts. Now, Kevin Sabet made this promise about the $1 in taxes and $10 in costs, and ever since he did that, me and other critics have been ribbing him. Like when Colorado said they made $100 million in tax revenue, we said, hey, where's the $1 billion in costs, Kevin? Where's the $1 billion in costs? Now he's trying to make shit up. He's actually trying to invent costs. This is a quote from him. He says, like the tobacco industry before it, the Colorado marijuana lobby is touting marijuana as the panacea for every contemporary challenge Colorado faces. The truth is, the health and safety costs caused by the commercialization of marijuana far outweigh any revenues collected. Drug use and its consequences already cost U.S. taxpayers over $193 billion a year in lost productivity, health, and safety costs. That's $3.3 billion for Colorado. Well, that's a Weasley thing to say. Number one, all drug use, heroin, coke, methamphetamine, ketamine, LSD, GHB, all drug use costs $193 billion, not just marijuana. And that study came from 2011, before we legalized. And one quarter of that $3.3 billion are the productivity costs he estimates based on losing productivity from people being locked up in jail. So if you're legalizing, you're not going to have that cost, right? And then any costs we'd have from pot are already there. They don't have to be illegal to not cost. So whatever costs we have are costs that we had, but we weren't getting tax money for it. Now, you got this thing about skunk here, right? Skunk weed, oh, the dreaded skunk, right? Super potent weed. In the States, they say it's not your father's Woodstock weed. They somehow contend that because it's more potent, it's a different drug. Well, it's non-toxic, so it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is how much of it you're consuming at any one time. And if it's legal, you're able to set up social mores and cultures around this. Like, none of us go into the bar and order a pint of tequila, right? We know better. It's potent. You don't order it by the pint. The same thing will happen with cannabis. The more it's legal, the more the social mores will dictate that, hey, dabs, you use a little bit of a dab. A little dab will do you.
Heavy, persistent use leads to significant IQ loss among young people.
So this is the myth of the lost IQ points for marijuana. This is the other cost. We're going to cost ourselves IQ points. This was based on a study in New Zealand that found that kids that smoked pot a lot when they were in teenage years lost like 6 to 8 points IQ in their middle age, even if they stopped smoking pot. It was bunk. Another researcher took the same numbers and realized it had more to do with poverty and racial conditions than it had to do with anything having to do with your pot use. And then recently, a study at King's College in London took identical twins, one who smoked pot, one who doesn't smoke pot, like thousands of them, and found that there was no difference in intelligence between the pot-smoking twin and the non-pot-smoking twin. Pretty much debunks any idea that we're going to be losing that. And in Washington and Colorado, the high school graduation rate keeps going up. So it must not be causing them too many IQ points.
Let's look at our cigarette policy over the last 80 years and not forget what happened. We had big tobacco peddling tobacco, saying, first of all, it's medicine. You know, in the 50s, tobacco was medicine. It's pretty interesting now with marijuana. They downplayed the harms to kids. They actually make money off of addiction. That is no model for marijuana.
So he always makes a big point about marijuana being the next big tobacco, and forgets one major consideration. Marijuana is not tobacco. Marijuana is neither toxic nor addictive. Big tobacco had to lie about its product because its product will kill you. That's a product you have to lie about. A product that does not kill you, probably don't have to lie about it as much. Another thing we hear in the States is, oh my God, there's more dispensaries than Starbucks. There's more pot shops than Starbucks and McDonald's combined. This is one of their graphs, right? It's another one of those weaselly kind of stats, because notice they're saying marijuana businesses. So that's growers, processors, testers, and retailers. But also they're comparing apples to oranges. McDonald's is one place I can get a burger. Starbucks is one place I can get coffee. If we had to count how many places you can get burgers and coffee compared to how many places you can get marijuana, well, here's what you find. In Seattle, there are twice as many coffee shops in just Seattle than pot shops in the whole state of Washington. So it's an apples to oranges comparison. They also like to say, oh my God, more kids are in rehab. Look at this. Oh, look at these people in rehab that are using more than 21 days a month. But this is a misleading graphic. First, they start at 22, so they cut off, you know, make it look taller than it is. This is all the people who are heavy users. So all they're saying here is heavy users are using more heavily. They're not saying more people are using more heavily, just the heavy users are. Well, yeah, because now they can go to the pot shop. They got a place to get it. And the overall admissions have been declining for rehab. So we're not having that addiction problem that they feared would happen. And when we look at the federal data for rehabs, these blue and green lines here, this is the rehab admissions for Washington and Colorado. This is Wyoming and New York State. They don't have legal weed, but they're much higher in their rehab admissions. And when you think about it, this makes sense. When we look at the federal data, they ask the people in rehab, how much weed did you smoke in the month you went to rehab? Half the people said they smoked less than once a week. Third of the people said they didn't smoke at all in the month before rehab. Well, how darn addictive is this drug if you can go a month without it and go to rehab? And half the people in rehab for marijuana are forced there by the criminal justice system. A drug court forces them to go to rehab. If your choice is jail or rehab, you'll pick rehab. So when we legalize marijuana, that's why all these rehabs go down. They don't have the court forcing people into rehab they don't need.
It's no accident that the liquor lobby and the liquor industry targets minorities in disadvantaged neighborhoods. There are 3 to 4 times more liquor stores in those neighborhoods than in upper-class white neighborhoods. That's
totally
going to happen with marijuana.
Now, I always found this to be an interesting objection, given that marijuana sales happen. Whether they're legal or illegal, marijuana sales happen. And so they are already happening in these neighborhoods. It's just they don't solve their problems with courts and lawsuits. They solve them with drive-by shootings. And once again, to illustrate this problem, I hammer away at this in my presentations about the inherent racism of American marijuana prohibition. And one way I illustrated this is because sometimes you hear statistics and they're just numbers. What I did is I took a look at one county in America, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, middle of America. Now, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 54% of the residents are non-Hispanic white. 19% are Hispanic or other races. And 27% of Milwaukee are black people, African American. So it's about a 2 white people, 1 Hispanic, 1 black person. A good mix for an American city, right? So I went and took a look at a site that does mugshots for people that get arrested. And it was the mug shots for people who were arrested for less than 25 grams of marijuana, a small personal amount. And I looked at this in January and February of 2012, and then just off eyesight and the surname of the person busted, I separated them out to the white mug shots, the Hispanic mug shots, and the black mug shots. And so the way it should work, if things are fair, we should stack up mug shots here in the white section and the Hispanic section and the black section pretty evenly. So we took the first 10, right? Okay, here's 10 white mug shots. And my apologies, I may have misclassified someone. Maybe he's Dominican, I didn't know, but here's 10 white mug shots, right? And then we got 10 Hispanic mug shots. And then we got 10 black mug shots, right? And so we'll just keep stacking them up and see how this turns out, right? Well, the problem is, I only got one more white mugshot. This is 2 months, people. 2 months of arrests for personal amounts of marijuana. I could only find 11 white mugshots. Hispanics, I found another 5. I have 15 Hispanic mugshots. Now, for African Americans, I was able to find another 10, right? So I got 20. Oh, who am I kidding? Move over, guys. 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 110, 120, 130, 138. So that's a pretty clear picture of what we're prohibiting marijuana for. Now, it's not a perfect stat because some of the mugshots are erased, like they get their lawyer to take the mugshot off. But guess who gets the lawyer to take the mugshot off? Mostly white people with privilege. So this is endemic to what's going on in American policing right now. And unfortunately, it still persists. We legalized weed, and it still persists. These gray bars are the marijuana arrest rates for black and non-black citizens in 2008. The red bars, black and non-black citizens in 2014. Now, it all went down, that's good, but the rate is still twice as much. Twice as much black to non-black, twice as much black to non-black. Colorado, twice as much, twice as much. So while legalizing marijuana will not end racism in the criminal justice system, you can't address that racism until you start to legalize marijuana. And the other thing that happens when he says they're going to put them all the pot shops in the neighborhoods, right? That's NIMBYism. That's not in my backyard. That's where affluent people vote to prevent those things from being set up. We'd love to have a pot shop in the Beverly Hills. We'd love to have a pot shop on the Upper East Side of New York, but they won't let us. They zone that stuff away. So it's a little disingenuous to say, you can't be here, you have to be there, and then complain that we're there. You only give us that choice. And the other thing that we're dealing with in the legalization of marijuana is the phenomenon of blacks did time, whites make dimes. And that is, we made these laws with legalization that if you had a prior criminal conviction, you couldn't get a license in the legal market. Well, who got all the prior criminal convictions? 4 times as likely, black and Latino people. So we're working on that to try to change some of these factors to change it from 1% of the dispensaries being owned by people of color. But we're winning. We are winning. This is a map of every United States opinion poll from 1969 all the way up to current day from various pollsters and news organizations, and we're now at 60% support for legalization. I bring this up because I said the UK was like at 2010 right now. We first hit 40. Now, right now, the UK public opinion polls are at 47% for legalization. We first hit 46 in 2001. Our second 46 was in 2006. We were starting to get consistently 46% right there in 2010. So I think you guys are really close to that breakthrough where you're going to start to see more reform happening as people become more aware of what cannabis is and that all these scare stories that I've shown you didn't come true. If you'd like any of this data, it is available through my website at mjagenda.com. You can download the slides, use them any way you like. I've got links to all the supporting data, so if you need to make a presentation to your MP or whoever it is that makes your laws, I'll be happy to help you with everything I can. My name's Russ Belville, Radical Russ Online. Thank you.